Just very briefly, I'm Erling Jorsten, and I teach at St. Olaf, and my field is American religious history. And my special interest is in recent American religious thought and doing different things at Holden, which I hope are interesting. And one of the things that I'm very much interested in is the general problem that everybody who comes here and everybody's back in their local congregations are concerned with, and that obviously is the relationship between what we call the gospel and the world, between our religious commitments and our involvement in the problems, the questions, the issues, the contests that we find in the world. And one of the great questions, of course, in America, and it's true in other Christian nations also, but it's especially true here, is the, and it's a slightly over, it's a slight oversimplification, but it helps set up the problem that I want to talk about. Does the church write the, you know, do our religious convictions write our agenda for how we should relate to the world, or does the world and the problems of the world write the agenda for what the church should be doing? How do you reconcile this kind of problem? Do we go out and take what the world has so far as problems are concerned, or do we go out from the church with what we believe should be done and meet the church in that particular way? This became a just a couple of words of historical background, then I want to get right into the 1970s. This became an especially important problem in the, first of all, around the turn of the century in the United States, when we got what we call the first social gospel movement in America. This came out especially of the enormous problems created by industrialization, the problems of the ghettos, of unemployment, of bad working conditions, of depressions, bad education, health care, any number of things. And there were several Protestant churches and the Catholic Church in some areas, and it should be said, well, I guess I'm not back in Minnesota. It's kind of hard to think I don't have a Minnesota audience because I want to talk about Bishop Ireland up in St. Paul, but I guess I can't. John Gibbon, but I can't do that so well because not everybody here is from Minnesota. But anyway, the Protestant churches and the Catholic churches, some of them at least, moved right into the inner city and tried to work out a way of living so that the church didn't become simply one more welfare agency, didn't become simply one more source for helping people in their social and economic crises, and was able to maintain its individuality and a sort of a sense of judgment really over the world itself. The social gospel movement developed some very interesting ideas. Out of it came the original Federal Council of Churches, which later on became the National Council of Churches, which is still very much alive and involved in some of these issues today, which I want to talk about. But the social gospel movement had its rise, really its first rise, and then sort of its diminution about World War I, when other problems came to occupy American churches at that time, and was pretty much in abeyance during the 20s, the 30s, and never really came back in any significant kind of form until the 1960s. In the 1960s, as we all know so well, and I don't want to talk about them because they're so well known, we had a tremendous outburst of energy and enthusiasm and involvement by many churches, by many clergymen across the country in both Protestant and Catholic faith and in the Jewish faith also, getting involved in the many problems, the war, the draft, ecology, the black liberation movement, the women's liberation movement, any number of these which we're all very much familiar with. And it seemed as though for a while that the thrust of the social gospel movement was going to pick up again in the 1960s, where it had been way back about before World War I. But then, as we also well know, suddenly, almost as suddenly as it began, the activist phase of the American church life went into virtual hibernation around the turn of the decade, around 1970 or so, in which there was a real backlash, that's the only word I can use here, against overextension. Many churches who had been heavily involved started losing significant amounts of money, membership started declining, enrollment, attendance I should say, started declining, large numbers of clergy defected from the ranks, dropped their participation in the churches. This is true both in the Catholic and in the Protestant churches. One good example of this, we remember as a very specific case study of what I'm getting at, was when the United Presbyterian Church, that's the big one in the North, decided to raise $10,000 to give to the defense fund for Angela Davis. And they couldn't have picked somebody who summed up the whole protest movement, I suppose, of the 60s any better than Angela Davis, black woman and communist, all wrapped up in one, which, isn't bad for, one homo sapien, all containing all these different trends, really, of the movement. And of course, as Presbyterians have said now, they probably lost over the long run millions of dollars in donations because people didn't want the churches to get involved in that sort of thing. But what's interesting, and this is what I want to talk about today, is that the social gospel is coming back in the United States, in American, and we don't call it Protestant and Catholic anymore because you can't really make the differentiation. The groups I'm going to be talking about today have both Protestants and Catholics in them, so that old separation really is out. And in fact, I've heard it said, and I think it's true, that there are many Catholics who are better Protestants than Protestants are today in terms of loyalty to the Bible and to the second person and so on. But anyway, the social gospel is coming back in a new way, and it has shown up, in three rather specific statements of faith which have come out in about the last 24 to 30 months in America. That is, within the last, since early 1974, and then just climaxing really this spring in Boston, we've had three distinct groups of persons who are both full-time theologians, professional theologians, and also activist people in church life, some officials from the NCC, some who are pastors, and a couple who are well-known Lutherans, and this is one reason I wanted to talk about it. We've got the very well-known activist from Brooklyn, Richard John Newhouse. I'm going to talk about a sort of a weather vane of what's happening now. And also, maybe some of you know Connie Parvey from Cambridge, an ordained LCA pastor who's very much involved in some of these movements. But anyway, we have three separate new statements about what the social gospel in America should be. Should the church write the agenda, or should the world set the agenda for the church? And in each of these cases, there is a direct head-on recognition of the need for both what we would call spiritual renewal and for restating basic theological affirmations on the one hand, and also how these theological affirmations should help inform us and motivate us and inspire us as to what the church should be doing in the world at this time. These aren't just simply learned theological papers which are given at conventions and are put into learned journals for other theologians to criticize and to evaluate, but these are statements by specific groups which I want to talk about here in some detail, which are addressed at redefining and putting in as precise words as possible what the church should be doing in the world and why the church should be doing what it is in the world. Not just that we should be in the world, but that we should be but why we should be in the world. Sort of a redefinition of theology. And what has happened is that these three events really, and for those of you who have read on this, what I'm talking about is the Hartford Affirmations, the Boston Statement, and the Chicago Declaration. If that makes sense. I know some of you in here would know what I'm talking about there if you've read the journals and so on, but I want to go into these in some detail. And what these are trying to do is to revive our interest in being aware and sensitive to our involvement in the world, because a lot of it is sort of repentance from the 1960s, because in the 1960s, for all their enthusiasm and interest, which was remarkable, oftentimes it was done without a great deal of care ahead of time. I remember a classic case where in our local congregation, where we had an activist pastor come in and go out there and charge and do what you're supposed to do. And what was wrong with some of the activists in the 1960s was that they didn't take the time to help explain what they were doing to rank and file in the congregations. And as a result, much of the activism in the 1960s got off in a corner here, where it was a group really of elitists who were very much involved, who had places like Bill Coffin at Yale, who were the chaplain at Yale, or who might be in some very prestigious position, and who got a lot of publicity, a lot of media attention, but who really didn't take the time to work with rank and file to bring them along. And as a result, when some of the backlash set in, such as it did with Angela Davis, for instance, and others I could mention, the movement really, in a sense, almost collapsed, because it was really only a few people, very bold and courageous people, to be sure, out on the one hand, without any sort of basis for support for them, because they hadn't really taken the time to explain to the people really why they were doing what they were doing. Okay, now, and so much for the background. Now, what's fascinating about the Chicago, Hartford, and Boston affirmations that have come around is that it's just like if you've ever watched people play bingo. Sometimes you put various little ping pong balls in the thing that you turn around with the numbers and the letters painted on them, and you get out a different combination every time you play a different game. And what's so interesting about these three declarations is that the old stereotypes, the old cliches about who is taking what stand simply no longer stand up any longer. For instance, I'll be talking about the Chicago group, In a little while. And what the Chicago group are, and this is a little oversimplification, is a group of fundamentalists who have become radical in their politics, which is a real switch, because if you would have talked about fundamentalists in the 40s or the 50s, you would have not assumed that the fundamentalists of those groups would have, or the new evangelicals, as sometimes some of them are called, would have gotten radical in politics at all. Or another group, basically the Hartford group. And that's a fascinating group because you've got a large number of theological and political radicals who have now become conservative in their theology and, for the most part, I think, in their ethics also. And the other group, the Boston group, is interesting because what you have there is a certain mix of sort of moderates and conservatives who have become liberal in their social outreach in the 1970s. So, you know, all the bets are off. All the old cliches, stereotypes, you know, that we grew up with are simply no longer applicable. What this means, from one thing, is of course that teachers have to rewrite their lectures because we can't, which we can't fall back on, you know, on the old platitudes any longer, or go to the well and bring out something that you know, was good 15, even 10 years ago, sometimes even 5 years ago, because conditions keep changing so much. All right, and let me start then with that background and this new mix and just go through the very briefly the Hartford, the Chicago, well, in this order, the Hartford, the Boston, and the Chicago declarations or affirmations, and then I'll make a couple of statements so far as what I think their importance is, and then we can, you know, I'd like to have a discussion on this. Now, it was in January of 1975 that a group of pastors and mostly professional theologians gathered at Hartford. It's a sort of a seminary there, where they put together, after subcommittee and study and so on, what we call the Hartford Affirmation. And the Hartford Affirmation is made up, the Hartford group, I should say, is made up primarily of former well-known liberals in politics and leaders in theology and in political thoughts, sociological thoughts, such as Peter Berger, for instance, and so on, all of whom decided that it was time to sort of rewrite the agenda for what the ongoing dialogue among Christians in America should be. Vern? Well, yeah, I was going to later, but I can put them in here. No, I've got, I'm trying on this, the best known one for many of us would be Richard John Neuhaus, and we had him on campus, and the campus is still reverberating from Neuhaus this spring. And another would be George Lindbeck. Some of you know there's another Lutheran who's at Yale. And another would be Avery Dulles, the famous Jesuit scholar from Catholic University, isn't he? He's in one of the Catholic universities in Washington, D.C. Yeah, he's at Catholic University, and he's the son of the former, you know, Secretary of State. And there would be Bill Coffin, the former Yale chaplain, and others. Peter Berger would be another one. He's Lutheran also, that's right. I don't know if there's a trend here or not. But anyway, the Hartford Affirmation. The Hartford Affirmation is made up of from a lot of people like those that I mentioned, who were very much involved in the activism of the 1960s, and in Hartford, what the whole thrust of the statement is for a return to an understanding of what we call the transcendent, the supernatural, for a recognition of the lordship of Christ in our lives. And generally speaking, what Hartford was trying to do was to call for a redefinition or a precise statement or systematic understanding of God's transcendence and man's finiteness in the world. Let me give you just a couple of examples of what I mean from this. All right, they set it up in sort of dialectical fashion. This is number 10 of their affirmations. The church must denounce oppression, help liberate the oppressed, and heal human misery. That sounds like good social gospel teachings, right? Nobody, you know, the Boston people wouldn't disagree with that at all. They must denounce oppression, help liberate the oppressed, and heal human misery. Then the second sentence, but the norms for the church's activity derive from its own perception of God's will for the world. There it is. You see the idea that the church itself sets the agenda, that the norms for, I'll read that again, for the church's activity derive from its own perception of God's will for the world. And in fact, one writer put it this way, the difference between Hartford and Boston is, if you take four words, and Hartford would say, God is all, comma, people, and Boston would say, God is all people. So far as the difference between where the, you know, where God is in the world, it's an oversimplification, but I think it's It's a nice way of putting it. And this is where I was going to bring in the people here. Now, what's so interesting about Hartford is, well, basically the ideas, of course, intrinsically in themselves are interesting, but the people who were in it, the people who decided to sign it, because almost all of these were very strongly and heavily involved, as I say, in the activism of the 60s. Let me take Richard John Neuhaus, just for fun. Who knows a little bit about Richard John Neuhaus, just for fun? Okay, I don't know how much, I know how much detail to go into with Richard John Neuhaus. He's an amazing, he's an amazing person. I suppose I disagree with 85 to 90% of what he says, but I must say he says it in an impressive, systematic way, and I remember it's sort of like Holden when he came to St. Olaf. He so electrified the place that sort of classes just stopped, and he just sort of had an ongoing dialogue down in Chapel 101, and just sort of went on, you know, and people came and people went, you know, just went on and on, and he was able to hold his own very nicely. But anyway, Richard John Neuhaus is a pastor of a Lutheran church in Brooklyn, St. John the Divine, and starting in the late 60s, or the middle 60s, was very heavily involved in some of the activist movements. He was especially interested in helping conscientious objectors and objecting to the draft. His congregation was the first, for instance, in America, in which draft card turn-ins were held, which took enormous courage, really, to do at that particular time. It became a fad later on, but Neuhaus's congregation was the first to do it. Neuhaus was the founder of an organization which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Clergy and Laity Concerned, about Vietnam, and which became sort of an activist group which marched and organized and demonstrated and distributed a lot of information. He went so far once as to call LBJ a murderer, you know, which is, you know, a pretty strong statement for a clergyman to make. He got involved in many of the battles, for instance, for black liberation and so on. And generally his credentials in the liberal to radical phase of the late 60s were in order, and he was mostly involved in these sort of things. The same thing can be said for William Sloan Coffin. Sloan Coffin was the chaplain at Yale, the Protestant chaplain at Yale, and a marvelous story about Coffin was that he was an early and vigorous critic of American involvement in Vietnam, and because he was so heavily involved making a commitment, and you know, he was one of the four who were arrested once, and they could never prove any conspiracy. I forget who some of the other, but Spock and two others were in on this, and there was supposed to be some conspiracy, and they could never even get an indictment. But as we know now from the Senator Church Committee, it was just harassment to keep some of these people quiet. But anyway, Coffin was so popular that he filled, for the first time, you know, in about 200 years, he filled the Protestant chapel on Sunday morning at New Haven. And the old alumni were really upset about this because, on the one hand, they were delighted that, you know, Yale undergraduates were finally going back to church, but, you know, which is something that Yale undergraduates hadn't done for 200 years since the days of the Great Awakening, really, with Jonathan Edwards. On the other hand, the reason they were going back to church was to hear Bill Coffin. So they didn't know which way to go. Should they start, you know, increasing their pledges because church attendance is going up or not? You know, it just was very difficult for them. Or Peter Berger would be another one. Avery Dulles was very much involved in these things. But the point is that now the former activists are coming out very strongly for supernatural understanding, for transcendent norms. Let me give you one example of a specific example of what I'm getting at, and then why I think this is really important. Now, this would be with Neuhaus. Neuhaus was very upset with the fact that many churches had lost what we would call the transcendent norm. And what he decided to do in Hartford was to show wherein what, you know, he would call liberal Protestant thought had missed the boat. Now, here is what he says the liberals are saying, and I quote here. Modern thought is superior to all past forms of understanding reality. Modern thought is superior to all past forms of understanding reality. Okay, that's one affirmation which the conservatives here say that the liberals are making. Now, a second one is this. All religions are equally valid. You know, we got the big influx from the East and so on. And a third one is this, quote, to realize one's potential and to be true to oneself is the whole meaning of salvation. We get into the whole, you know, human potential movement here. This, if any of you know Abraham Maslow and self-actualization, this whole trend is very important. To realize one's potential and to be true to oneself is the whole meaning of salvation. Now, these are three statements that the Hartford people are saying that the liberals are making. And this is Neuhaus's reply. Salvation contains a promise of human fulfillment, but to identify salvation with human fulfillment is to trivialize the promise. We affirm that salvation cannot be found apart from God. I'll repeat that just very briefly. Salvation contains a promise of human fulfillment. That's, the here and the now. But to identify salvation with human fulfillment, this is what we call, being a whole person. That's a catchy phrase right now. But to identify salvation with human fulfillment is to trivialize the promise. We affirm that salvation cannot be found apart from God. All right. What I think is important about the Hartford statements is a return to an interest and enthusiasm for a more careful definition of the role of the Christian in the world on the basis of agreed upon theological norms from the beginning. But what is also important is a return to a sense of judgment and transcendence rather than simply to jump into the world and getting involved in the world before one really has a clear sense of what is happening. All right, so much for Hartford. Now, a second one came out last year in Boston, and it wasn't, as some people have thought, it wasn't intended simply as a rebuttal to Hartford. The work which went into the Boston statement had been going on for about 2 years before. The subcommittees and the studies and the drafts and the reports and so on had been going on for some time. There were a group of people in religious life in the general in the larger Boston area, and the best known for us, I'm sure, would be Connie Parvey, who had been thinking about preparing some sort of statement about the church, the agenda, social involvement, and so on. And we're aware, after they had started their plans for a fresh new statement, that Hartford was coming out, but decided, obviously, to finish theirs themselves. And the difference with the Boston statement is not only in the greater concern for getting involved in the problems of this world, and not so much direct concern with having agreed upon theological norms as a foundation for it. But it's interesting that the Boston statement has the signatures of far more, what would you say, non-academic persons in religious life than the Hartford one. There has to be, the one thing that has to be said about Hartford is that it has sort of an academic touch to it, which the Boston statement doesn't have, which may or may not really be too important, but it indicates that there are significant kinds of differences. Now, they argue that the Hartford statement, the return to transcendence, isn't necessarily wrong, that the return to greater concern for discipleship isn't wrong, but is simply misguided, that the priorities simply have moved in the wrong direction. And what Boston has attempted to do is not so much to refute the Hartford statement, although Harvey Cox tried it a couple of times. They had some famous showdowns, which turned out to be just media events. Cox will take on anybody at the dear old 475 Riverside Drive, and as long as Time and Newsweek were there, then Time and Newsweek sort of set it up. Ken Underwood and some of the others, just as what Martin Marty calls media hype, or hype, which is a short word for hyperbole, just to get something going. But the Boston people weren't trying simply to refute Hartford, but they were trying to make a statement which they thought was not the opposite of Hartford, but which would move the dialogue in a somewhat different direction. Now, just very brief summary of their statements. They argue that many of the issues or the questions of the 1960s are really no longer relevant for the 1970s. For instance, the question of black liberation is one which needed to be attacked directly in the 1960s, but in the 1970s has been largely absorbed into the black community itself. The leadership and the momentum and the energy from it coming from blacks rather than from the white community, as it had been the case in the mid-1960s. And furthermore, there are many other cases, for instance, or specific examples of racial injustice in the world in which we can no longer, do very much. The Boston people are ready to acknowledge, for instance, that racial injustice in South Africa is not going to be corrected nor even rippled by demanding that corporations who have portfolios of investments in South African companies should be boycotted or something. They recognize that there is going to be ongoing racial injustice in South Africa and in Chile, Rhodesia, and so on, and that there really isn't much the church can do there. But what Boston is calling for is attacking those problems where churches, especially on the local level, can do something. And the number one issue there, of course, is world hunger. World hunger because, as I say, the churches can't do much about some of the other issues, as sad as they might be. For instance, I think you've all read about the torture, for instance, in some of the Latin American countries and so on, and it's just enough to blow your mind, but what can we do? But we can do something about some of the other issues, and one of these would be, for instance, world hunger. And world hunger is something which is even more, according to Boston, even more radical, because if we take world hunger seriously, and this is something that Al Pitcher up here is calling for and making, is very much involved in himself, if we take the world hunger issue very seriously, what this will mean, obviously, is a drastic revision, in a very real sense, downward of our own lifestyles. But this is something which each individual person can manage and have some control over for himself. And furthermore, they argue that by contrast to the 1960s, the involvement in the world by the church no longer has sort of the, how should I say, the epic character to it, or the national sweep. They realize that perhaps all the marches and the demonstrations and all the rest may well have mobilized public opinion, but in the last analysis, they didn't. They really didn't do very much, especially when the incumbent said he'd rather watch a football game on Saturday afternoon, you remember, than pay attention to 250,000 voters, you know, outside the White House, which, you know, tends to polarize, you know, the situation slightly, to make an understatement. But they would argue, Boston would argue, that what the churches have to do now is work for social involvement on the local level, rather than on the, you know, the regional or the national level. And one reason this seems to be muted now, they argue, is that it's not national anymore, and the big media agencies don't give it a great deal of attention anymore, because there really isn't anything very spectacular in a local congregation with its, you know, Food for Nigeria fund, or with its local hotline, or with its drug counseling program, or whatever might, you know, the case might be. But basically the Boston argument is for maintenance of social involvement, and not so much preoccupation with the theological norms which the Hartford people are interested in. All right, let me read just one quotation here, because it gives an indication of what Boston is trying to say. We are surrounded by a cloud of witnesses who prophetically exemplify or discern the activity of God. The transforming reality of God's reign is found today in the struggles of the poor to gain its share of the world's wealth, in the transforming drive for the ethnic dignity against the persistent racism of human hearts and social institutions, in the endeavor by women to overcome sexist subordination, in the attempts within families to overcome prideful domination and degrading passivity. Now, that's a mind-blower of a statement that I read too fast, but let me say, read it again and sort of say what they're saying. What they are saying is that God's activity in the world today, where God is at, is in these specific areas that I read off much too fast for you here, that they discern the activity of God in these specific points. For instance, in the struggles of the poor to gain a share of the world's wealth, in the transforming drive for ethnic dignity against the persistent racism of human hearts and social institutions, in the endeavor by women to overcome sexist subordination, in the attempts within families to overcome prideful domination and degrading passivity. That's pretty strong stuff. When you locate, you know, where the kingdom is at, where the action is at there, that's a very clear and precise kind of statement. All right. Now, what's interesting there is, besides the statements, which are intrinsically interesting in themselves, is the fact that many of those who signed the Boston Statement had not really been leaders in the activist phase of church involvement before. But in the 70s, recognizing the sort of the loss of momentum, or the seemingly loss of momentum for involvement in the world, have decided to make their particular stand and you know, take their and issue this statement to the world. Now, the third group that I want to talk about, and one which doesn't get so much publicity because it's not so well known in Reformation Church circles, is that of the Chicago Declaration. This was in late 1973, but it never sort of really got off the ground and became a significant statement until about last year. And really, that movement is remarkable because it's attracted some good sort of follow-up statements. And one book, too lazy to go to the board here, but one especially good book which I would recommend for you to read is by a professor of philosophy at Calvin College. And Calvin really is furnishing the intellectual leadership, I think, for this movement. It's Richard Mouw, M-O-U-W, Richard Mouw. It's called Political Evangelism. And it's an especially sophisticated and good statement of how what we would call sort of updated fundamentalism can relate directly to the social, political, and economic issues of the day. Richard Mouw, M-O-U-W, Political Evangelism. I think it's Erdmann's, if I'm not mistaken. Erdmann's is right in Grand Rapids, too. It's kind of easy. You don't have to mail your manuscripts if you live in Grand Rapids. But
do you have references to the other
statements? Do I have which?
References?
Yeah, I can get you references afterwards, sure. For these. Basically, the best journal to look for, the best journal to look is the Princeton Journal, the Princeton Quarterly, Theology Today. Abingdon's is good too, Religion and Life, but you can find all of the basic statements in Princeton. Well, it's a quarterly, which Princeton University Press puts out, Theology Today. And Newhouse's magazine also, and Berger's magazine, Worldview, that's a monthly, is very good also on this sort of thing. But I remember, Vern, when I sent Hartford to you, that was from Theology Today, which is my particular favorite quarterly, although I think Abingdon's is, I mean, well, Religion and Life is just as good. All right.
The third... They had been making a public show of their almsgiving. And he says a similar thing about their much praying. Verse 5. And when you pray, he's talking to his disciples, you must not be like the hypocrites. For they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward. People think that they are really enormously religious people. If in that world, if you ask now,
is my particular favorite quarterly, although I think Abingdon's is, I mean, well, Religion and Life is just as good. All right. The third group can be called, sometimes it's called New Evangelical, and what they amount to really are a group of younger activists, not only, you know, professors and theologians, but people who are very much involved in specific activist reform movements, who come out of the old fundamentalist tradition where everything was conservative, your politics, your theology, your lifestyle, everything, and there really was... a conviction that, you know, the old premillennial conviction that since the world was going to end anyway, that, you know, the second coming was imminent, that there really wasn't any sense in getting involved in the social and economic struggles and issues of this day, but one should get directly involved in preparing oneself for the hereafter. And starting, it's a long, long story on how the change took place, which we don't have to go into here, but starting in the late or the middle 1960s, I suppose it was largely because of the war and the draft and black struggles and so on, a new generation, really, of very sophisticated and knowledgeable young men and women in the new evangelical tradition started to break away from the old one and found enormous kinds of resistance. You can, if you read Christianity Today very carefully, you can see the tension within the magazine itself, because the editor-in-chief, Harold Inzel, is of the old school. I mean, is he of the old school? I mean, Dittmanson would call it Christianity Yesterday, but that's just another, you know, just another kind of, you know, theologian thing. But he's very conservative, whereas on the other hand, you can find lots of younger people. My particular favorite is Jim Wallace, who's got a good new book out from Harper, and Nancy Hardesty, the Daytons, Ron Sider, for instance, and so on, who are trying to show a respect for the old traditional emphasis that they have on the inerrant Bible on the one hand, but yet a deep involvement in the affairs and the issues of this world at the other. And what happened was that in a very unspectacular place, and nothing could be more unspectacular, I think, than the downtown Chicago YMCA. That has to be about as drab, you know, a setting for, you know, a church meeting as one could find, because Hartford was done in, you know, in Boston in full, you know, media view and so on. They came up with a remarkable statement which is gaining more attention all the time, and I would like to read sort of the preamble to it, because it gives a good sort of, you know, this sets a tone for the more specific areas which they feel that, you know, the church should attack. All right, and I quote here: "We acknowledge that we have failed to condemn the exploitation of racism at home and abroad by our economic system. That's remarkable, because they're criticizing the economic system, and for fundamentalists to criticize capitalism is, you know, that's, they've come a long ways, just like Virginia Slim or whatever, they've come a long ways, really. Before God and a billion hungry neighbors, we must rethink our values regarding our present standard of living and promote more just acquisition and distribution of the world's resources. We must challenge the misplaced trust of the nation in economic and military might, a proud trust that promotes a national pathology of war and violence, which victimizes our neighbors at home and abroad. We must resist the temptation to make the nation and its institutions objects of near religious loyalty. We acknowledge that we have encouraged men to prideful domination and women to irresponsible passivity. All in the sense, really, here you see of a confession of all the sins and the errors and the misjudgments which they have made over a long period of time. And what has happened, and what's so important about Chicago is the statements in themselves, but also the fact that these very conservative Protestants have become involved, for the most part, in all kinds of not only liberal, but I would call them radical activities today. These are not statements really of academics, but there are large numbers of, well, not large, but where they are large in numbers. There are increasing numbers of communities appearing, first of all, around Chicago and Reba Place, for instance, and so on, and now in Washington, which are dedicated really to a radical critique of the American lifestyle such as we know it today. Many of the people who signed the Chicago Statement, for instance, are totally opposed to capitalism. They feel that it simply encourages greed, waste, and domination and subjection and oppression, which they feel totally unacceptable. Many of these are very critical of America as the whole American political system. And many of these, I should say furthermore, come out of a sort of an Anabaptist tradition, which has always been in tension with the state itself, and see the state as a necessary evil, but if they had their way, they would reduce the power of the state, especially with its police powers, as great as possible, because they see the temptation for the state to acquire more and more power over their lives rather than less and less power. These come directly out of the old Anabaptist tradition way back in Reformation days. And they're also very much opposed to what we would call upper middle class lifestyles, with its heavy consumption and its emphasis on leisure goods and on luxury goods altogether. And you'll find, for instance, in the communities, and the most important one now is in Washington, a very decided attempt to cut back on the standard of living, on the amount of energy and food and all the rest of the things which are used, and an attempt to reach out to the community and simply minister to the community at large. And for old-line fundamentalists, and really these are sort of the children, I suppose you could say, of the old-line fundamentalists to do this, is a remarkable statement of how far all the different religious groups have really gone in America. So I would simply like to close here by saying that what I think this shows is new forces at work, new economic and social forces at work in America, new intellectual forces at work in America, and the social gospel may not be the same in the 1970s as we thought it was in the 1960s, but I think the fact that these three groups have made firm affirmations and are willing to engage in dialogue and discussion with one another and sort of get the word out to the congregations also is an indication that perhaps in the United States we may have the opportunity to sit back, not sit back, that's the last thing, but to reflect and then to get involved once again in what was so, in the late 60s, what seemed to be so promising a movement. And my own personal feeling, and just my only comment on this, is I don't feel that all of these three groups are necessarily that far apart. But for all kinds of reasons, personality and whatever, they've taken separate statements, have gone separate routes, but it's very possible, I think, in the future that they may get together. But anyway, so we have really, three different sort of accents, not necessarily contradictory accents, but three new accents, three new kinds of voices in the, in this original problem that I talked about. How does the gospel and our social concern interact in the world in which we are today? So any comments or questions you'd care to make, I'd be delighted to encourage. This was only providing information. Yeah.
Historically, what impact have these kinds of statements made?
Yeah. A lot of time people say this is just academics or what Marty calls a high, media hype. In fact, he calls it that. I mean, he's very cynical about it. He says that Hartford was simply the fact that some of these people realized the churches weren't getting much attention, so they decided to have an event, which I think is much too cynical. But a lot of times what happens with these kinds of movements is, these kinds of statements is that they serve to create more public attention in what's going on than would have been the case before. And they aren't just, you know, statements that, the ivory tower people hand around, you know, at conventions to each other. There's, goodness knows, been enough of those, and some of us have attended those meetings, you know, for years and years and read those statements. But I think where boards of social concern, for instance, in the Protestant denominations and the Catholic Church, look on these and reflect on these and, in a sense, try to pass them on through various forms to the congregations, they could well have, you know, a very decided impact, because they tend to focus our attention on some rather specific issues. And there are enough differences so that we don't just sort of sit back and yawn and say, you know, well, here's another statement. But it's like, you know, getting in the middle of a lake and dropping a large stone, and the ripple, hopefully, you know, effect will all the way reach the shores. That's at least what I hope will happen. And I think that's possibly what can happen once we continue to face issues which I think are going to, you know, stay on the agenda for a long time: hunger, energy, these sorts of things. And so the question then becomes, what, you know, how should we relate to these? And as people, as heirs really of Reformation denominations, we'd like to start with, you know, scriptural and theological statements as to why we should get involved in these. And that's what I think these statements are sort of offering us. Paul, and then George.
I was intrigued by your statement that the fundamentalists criticize capitalism has come a long way. Because if you think back to William Penn and Bryan, you have to go back far enough to realize that the fundamentalists are quite active.
Yeah, but his was with what he called an abuse. I mean, these people are calling for some form of real decentralization. I know the Cross of Gold, right? Jennings Bryan, he's one of my particular favorites. I grant you that.
The question that this raises, at least in my mind, is why, well, I would just add that in the late 19th century, some staunch defenders of capitalism among the clergy were highly liberal.
Yeah.
The cleric, let's say, fair school. But I wonder, what causes fundamentalists or liberals, you know, to come out and take any position with respect to social issues? And I wonder if very often it isn't a sense that we don't have a theology, and so we got to, sometimes, I think the fundamentalists in recent years, for example, have been taken conservative positions partly out of resentment of the anti-capitalist positions taken by the liberals, whom they think are substituting social activism for theology.
Yeah, that's what Carl Henry, you know, the old editor of Christianity Today, says. And I think that I can't explain the, you know, the exact way in which sort of information gets out, but a lot of the younger people who have had probably better education, who are, you know, in a new America where you don't have the old kinds of social cohesion or social forces placed on them by parents who could travel more and relate more, who probably go to better colleges, for instance, than Bob Jones, for instance, and although I shouldn't pick the worst one, I suppose, is my example, and so on, simply realize that the gospel has more to do with the world than their parents had thought was the case. And there was almost the apathy on the part of older fundamentalists simply to accept the status quo as it existed, because they believed in, you know, we should have gotten into this, really. They believed in the old, you know, Puritan ethic of hard work and thrift and self-discipline. And that seemed to harmonize with conservative theology. And what the younger generation are saying is, you know, something else. Hard work and thrift and self-discipline and self-denial aren't necessarily, you know, the wherewithal. We have a slogan for a bank back in Minneapolis that I like to use, you know, tuck a buck a day away. That simply no longer makes sense to a large number of younger people, because they look at the fruits of industrial capitalism with pollution and, you know, and all the rest, and they say, if this is where it's leading, they don't want any part of it. And that's what I mean by the break. From that, what you know, inner kind of motivation there is there, I you know, you'd have to get into psychology, but I think they have sincere theological, you know, commitment to what they're trying to do, and they simply have seen the United States in a whole different light. It's really the generation gap thing. They, you know, the thing I always hear, I mean, you know, is the thing I, how do I say it, is that we always tell the people who were born about 1940 or 50, you don't know how we suffered during the Depression. That's one thing. And you don't know what it was like to, you know, to fight the Nazis. And, you know, the kids who are 20 now don't pay any attention to that. You can't, you know, that doesn't get you anywhere in the classroom any longer. And I think the younger new evangelicals are in that particular school. This simply is irrelevant to them. The Depression of 29, it doesn't mean anything to them anymore. Or the kind of, you know, emotionalism that came with the Nazis and all the rest doesn't mean anything. George?
I think it should get on the record that the Presbyterian Church did not pay for Angela Davis's defense. that was withdrawn after it was suggested by a group within the church, and a black caucus made it up instead. Yep. But it became a sort of a symbol for those who were dissatisfied with the mainline churches. The second thing I think should get on the record is that, as I get letters all the time, that the reason that the mainline churches are going downhill is because they've gone into the social gospel and they've gone into modernism and have left the true faith. And that, by contrast, those small fundamentalistic groups are succeeding and multiplying themselves because they still hold to the old Bible and its literalism. That also is a misreading. Dean Kelly, who did the study, included in the fundamentalistic churches that were burgeoning so fast the Mormons, which are not Christian in the sense that we understand Christian, with the gospel of Jesus Christ as Savior alone. And in a study done that was reported this year at the United Methodist Quadrennial Convention, Mark Hartman, did an entire study. As you have read, I'm sure, the Methodist Church lost 10% of its membership in the last 4 years since the last quadrennial. And it is widely said that's because Methodists have left the true faith and have gone into the social gospel. His study indicates that this is not true at all, that the defections have not increased over the decades, but that the emphasis on evangelism has decreased, even to the budgetary differentials of maybe 90% cutback in budgeting for evangelism. And that it was not, for instance, that there were less kids, as we used to pass around in the American Lutheran Church 5 years ago. Well, the birth rate is down, and that's why. Because that thing was preceding, was going along at a 4 times the rate of defections, or the lack of interest in the Sunday school, 4 times the rate of the birth rate decline. So that the essential difference is that these mainline churches have given up going out and evangelizing, personal evangelism. Yeah. That's where the difference is. I think that might be important for us to recognize as we deal with these churches.
Yeah, that's none of the affirmations that I've talked about took up evangelism as such. And of course, there's been some disenchantment because Key 73 was such a bust that some people have.
Except I don't really believe that. I hear that in the American Lutheran Church all the time, and I think that 2/3 of the evangelical prayer groups and so on that are around the country today meeting among all the denominations were spawned out of Key 73. People going to their neighbors and saying, let's study the Bible together.
Is that where this one from California, I heard about it, I didn't even know about Bible study fellowship?
Ooh.
Is that where, did it get started in Key 73?
I don't know where I received that.
Oh, because I honestly didn't know about it. I was fascinated. Two women here 2 weeks ago from California were very much enthused about it. Okay, I saw another hand. Yeah.
I just wonder if one of your original questions was ever answered about who sets the agenda for whom. Did you ever?
That's an ongoing, that's the ongoing question, which will never be, it's a chicken and egg argument is what it is. And it should be left open. It shouldn't be like Seventh-day Adventists or whoever, some other groups where they're everything is closed.
Does compromise come in there?
I think modesty is a better word here, because who can say what exactly, except unless you've had a direct pipeline, what God is telling us to do. That's what I worry about with some of my friends who come around door to door on Saturday afternoons, and they found our house because it's air conditioned. I shouldn't be cynical, really. Although I had a 4-hour go round with the Mormons, and I don't know.
The trend in colleges like St. Olaf?
This way?
Right.
It's hard to read right now because I have noticed, I don't know, Vern isn't here, but if any of the rest of you are college teachers, please contribute, that there is a change even between seniors and freshmen this year.
Well, I would imagine, but I'm wanting to know what the trend is.
Well, they aren't very interested in formal theology as such. The theology courses don't draw well in firm terms of enrollment. What always draws well, of course, are good teachers. I mean, no matter what, that's something that goes back all the way. But there's more specific interest in ethical issues. Of course, the Quinlan case, got all kinds of attention. And the whole matter right now of death and dying is, tremendously big in.
Why is that?
Among kids, let me ask.
What's the deal?
Anybody want to take it? You know, it's just booming.
Kids are dying, that's why. No, frankly, this is my opinion. I'm a high school teacher.
Yeah, I'd like to know,
and
really. I just...
I talked about Karen Ann Quinlan in my classes a lot this year. One of the reasons I think that we talked about it a lot, and it wasn't I that brought it up, my kids brought it up. They wanted to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I had two kids in my classes die of drug overdoses this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very close to them.
Yeah, it's a very close kind of thing to them.
Okay. It is something we have to talk about.
Maybe that with war and famine and pollution and all the rest, you know, making death a little bit more close than it was, you know, in our day. I think that's, in the Quinlan case, of course, it was one of the dramatic cases. It isn't necessarily the best case to study the whole thing, but did she finally die? I, you know, been
still alive.
Even after being off the...
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm a little intrigued by the statements and how the fundamentalist group now is seemingly expressing more concern for issues and dealing with problems that we confront in the world, and the liberals now going back to the transcendent thing, and then the statement that was brought over here.
That's coffee, thank you. It won't hurt my feelings if you go.
Lack of evangelism amongst those churches, like the Methodist Church, that have now become more sensitive to the issues that confront the people that they're ministering in the midst of.
Mm-hmm.
And yet their ministry of evangelism,
yeah,
ends. How is it we have the same problem in our own church, the Lutheran Church, the LCA, you know. Evangelism, it's either way up or it's nothing. And if you keep balance, that's an impossibility. You know, to go about carrying on ministry in the world and meeting people in the needs at the same time as you're proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ. I thought they were synonymous.
I think they are. I remember once there was a good state article, George, in the Standard. It simply was entitled, The Gospel is Social. I forget, about 2-3 years ago. And I think it was it Jim Burton? No, it wasn't Jim, but anyway, it was a very good, you know, very good statement for this, and I don't see the difference.
I don't either, but I mean, it's amazing to me.
But what happens, this is what I was trying to say about the some of the clergy in the 60s didn't give any attention to rank and file, and I think that's where they separated the two, because the movement became sort of an elitist, ivory tower sort of thing.
Well, you know, one of the things, there was an article in the Lutheran here a few years ago about the new pastors. Don't expect them to visit in your home.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that a big part of it? You know, this whole idea of the non-relatedness, the non-going out and talking to people person to person, but taking issue and working in a group.
In fact,
and people, you know, don't see.
Connie has stated that one problem facing the pastors today is that the role isn't as well defined as it was, you know, a few years ago, and that's a very difficult thing, because
it expands but doesn't have definition.
Yeah. And you're supposed to do more. It's what it really amounts to, is that your role means you're supposed to do more of everything.
Yeah, right.
More, right.
The more is the definition.
More is the definition of a new role.
More is better.
More knowledge about business and taxes and more about everything, right. I'm sorry.
Well, don't identify the Chicago group as fundamentalist.
Well, you have to make a matter of definition there, because the new evangelical people don't call themselves, you know, fundamentalists.
Right, but there's the
they come out of the fundamentalist tradition.
You know, grabbing people. Don't identify too well with the Chicago statement.
Well, of course, if we get into which group you're talking about, because I mean the new evangelical when I'm talking about the Chicago Declaration, and the people like Ron Sider and Jim Wallace and those. That's
Didn't she say that?
Excuse me, Paul.
Didn't she say that not all new evangelicals are social activists? That's what you're making.
No, they all are.
That not all fundamentalists are new evangelicals.
Yeah,
right.
And
but,
that. A lot of the growth that is being seen in the statistics is going to those fundamentalist churches that
are not
socially active.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Not trying to be unkind, or anything, you were mentioning at first that these groups are changing their position, and I wonder if it isn't a little bit, or you may comment on maybe a little bit a psychological effect of a group of rebels. Basically, we're all rebels to a certain degree, who are trying to find a cause.
Yeah.
In other words, in the 60s, they were well defined. Now, there's going to be later in the 70s I think with the crisis we're facing in food and that sort of thing, there's going to be more well-defined causes than there are at the moment. It seems to me maybe this is one of the reasons why you get these groups that are just searching for things to do now that would be as dramatic and as effective as they were in the 60s.
Well, most of these people really feel, you know, involved and committed, and if where they err, like maybe Marty is right in part that they err because they aren't adverse to publicity, but I wouldn't pass them off simply as headline seekers, the way, you know, some people have done. But a lot of them feel guilty, and I can appreciate that because I'm white and Anglo-Saxon and Protestant and upper middle class and college educated, and, you know, I'm the enemy. Really, because I can't join any cause right now. And sometimes I wonder about myself. There's, you know, all the rest of them are all the other groups are sort of have their own thing going, and where do I fit in? So the only thing I can do is write, you know, histories. You know, I remember it was the same way in high school. I had a heart condition, so I couldn't play sports, but I was the sports reporter. That's the best thing I could do, you know, to compensate. And the same thing is true now. A lot of these people are that way, and Newhouse says this himself directly, and Peter Berger. That they don't hide this from this, and what they're trying to do then is to find some place where they can use their interests and their abilities, you know, to do the right. No question about that. But they want to feel involved. They can't live with their conscience and not doing anything, because just to sit back and become passive is wrong also.
It doesn't really make much difference which way they go, whether they go fundamental route or they go radical route. They're still changing their position to try to seek something that's more...
Well, I think they're sincere because there are a lot of, not only this is interesting and maybe it's just too specialized here, but there are a lot of former liberals in politics who are becoming really quite conservative in politics today. Moynihan would be a very good example. There's a quarterly magazine some of you might know called The Public Interest. And Commentary Magazine, a monthly, which is made up of a lot of former, you know, liberals. Mike Novak would be another one. Well, he changes his position every 2 years anyway. So, this year he's come out for sports as the great new American expression of religion is his latest statement. And, I don't know, but anyway, there are shifts. But a lot of the, I'm trying to think of the Nathan Glazer or their Daniel Bell. This group is very interesting.
There's been quite a shift in that Eastern establishment.
Yeah.
You mentioned in Commentary and
Public Interest. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you, they really. Some would call it retrenchment, I suppose, and others would call it New Horizon, but it's really New Horizon.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, the chief critic right now of affirmative action, which is about as big a liberal cause as there is Nathan Glazer, who is, you know, who was one of the brain trusters for the early liberalism of the 60s, and now he's recanted.
Let's not rule out the possibility that their change of position has come from a more careful analysis of the issue.
Oh, well, now that's what you would say, Paul, you know. That's what, you know, you would say. But I don't mind this because there's, you know, I wish I could remember. Old Senator Dirksen had the best, I can't find it. He had a marvelous statement about people who don't change their minds. I wish I could find it because it is only as old Ev could do it, you know, and that Glossomer in prose of his. I can't find it, but it'll come to me someday. And, you know, the new thing, you know, new issues come up. We didn't think about ecology at all 10 years ago. World hunger was the big issue. And so we have to find new, you know, things. And what I learned is that that's what's so interesting, really, about sort of theological expression, because theology is a man-made kind of form of activity in which, you know, you're looking for things. There's a difference between theology and doctrine. And theology, I think, will always be in this sort of thing. Some people will say, well, can't we just let things alone for a few years? I remember I had an aunt once, a marvelous statement where they were talking about exploring the moon. And she just got up and she just said, can't they leave the moon alone? You know, why in the world do they have to bother with the moon? She just wanted a few things to be left alone. You know, she was tired of all this change. And, you know, I think we tend to get excited when theologians do change their position, but I think you have to give them credit for sincerity on this. Okay? You had one way back when, I'm sorry.
Well, I come up with a new one, too. On this idea of the youth with dying.
Yeah, that's an interesting
and
one.
And the fact that here we are now, 16 years into causes which haven't really been too much done about. You know, I mean, they're still there, and new ones keep popping up and all that, and...
This is the ultimate cause?
I think that, yeah, I think that, no, that the idea that, well, we're going to have these causes, nothing's really going to be done, Yeah, and death, that's the one. You know, that's the one that's going to come.
Well, there's no question that, you know, in the 70s, there is what I call the trip inward. There's much more concern with one's inner state and being, and, you know, the whole thing with TM is a very good expression of this or example of this. And much more concerned with inner growth and so on and personal issues than was the case in the 60s. And I think in one case that's the death thing is a part of that. It may be a fad. I don't know.
I don't think. I think there's one thing we overlooked, and I think Henry hit on it, was that when something comes very close to you,
yeah,
then you begin, then becomes real. And we can criticize our mass media a heck of a lot because of the stuff they put on and so forth. But really, if you take the Vietnam situation, for instance, they were able to communicate with this nation a lot more than they ever done in a regular, in a real war.